Well, as we continue talking with Andy Lloyd about his work, Darker Stars, let's take your phone calls as well here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Andy Lloyd with us. Andy, we were talking more about the Zachariah Sitchin and his work. Will he ever be vindicated, do you think?
I wish he'd been vindicated during his lifetime.
Me too.
Oh, wow, that would have been a thing, wouldn't it? I think he will. I 20 years. I've been devoted to this. I think I don't get paid for it. I don't, it's not my professional thing. It's
right, and books really don't make a lot of money these days.
Oh, my goodness, they really don't. Mm. And, I have a passion for this. So, something in me, this really, his work really, really resonates. And, I think it does for a lot of people. I think they read it and they realize it opens their eyes to all kinds of different possibilities. So, we were saying about the scientific sort of mentality, which is more, we just find a planet, it's a planet. Until the evidence is there to the contrary, you can't say anything more about it than it's just a planet. But, if his work is the opus that he's created, creates predictions, it's a predictive tool, and the predictions turn out to be, largely correct, if not completely correct, then, it creates a sort of a question. It must create a question in people's mind. How did this come about? So, my caution with this really is this whole 3,600. I've always been a little bit dicey with it. And the reason is that, where that number came from, the 3,600 years, was to do with the Sumerian sexagesimal system.
Mm-hmm.
Sitchin related beautifully.
Well, and you would think, Andy, knowing that elliptical orbit by years, if it was 3,600, that they could pinpoint it exactly with modern computers. You just program it in, right?
Yes. So at 3,600, 3,600 years sounds like an extraordinarily large amount of time. And, Neptune's orbit in comparison to that and Pluto's orbit, which is sort of measured in sort of hundreds of years, 3,600 years seems an extraordinary period of time. But, as you move out into the outer solar system and you get progressively more distant, those years clock up very, very fast. So you have Kuiper Belt objects that are kind of going around the solar system probably, I don't know, about a 1,000-year period, so on. And then once you get out to the comets, the inner disk of comets, the inner Oort cloud, you're into the sort of tens of thousands of years, going up to hundreds of thousands of years then. And it quickly escalates. So 3,600 years doesn't buy you a lot of real estate. And the problem with that is that, as you're saying, because you can use the evidence that we've got as a quite a good predictive tool, if you're going to attach it to a number like 3,600 years, you can work out then how bright this thing should be, reflecting light back from the sun. And then when you sort of put that number into sky searches, with infrared telescopes and other surveys that have been done, You have to argue, well, actually, where is it? Why haven't we found it?
Exactly.
Because the brightness of this thing that's predicted by theory should mean that those surveys pop it up. And, I went through a sort of a dark night of the soul about 6 years ago where WISE, I think it was 2013, WISE, which was the infrared space telescope that was doing the survey, they turned up blank on Planet X. And there'd been some guys working on that program who were really into brown dwarfs, and they were really hopeful of finding a brown dwarf or a sub-brown dwarf in the outer solar system. So the fact that there was a disappointment took that quite seriously. And I thought to myself, well, that's it, game over, really, because they were saying, well, something the size of what I was talking about, you wouldn't be able to find until you went out to sort of, some ridiculous distance halfway towards the nearest star, really. So that worried me a bit, and I was sort of, that's probably why you haven't heard from me for a long time, George.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Actually, you've been away for 10 years.
Yeah, because I kind of thought, well, maybe, just maybe what I'd written was just absolutely load of rubbish. And I sort of went through this dark night of the soul. And then Planet Nine came along in 2016 because they'd realized that these objects in the outer solar system were in a mathematical way, and it's quite complex. And again, I'd point people to the book for this because to explain it over the radio is quite tricky. But essentially, these outer objects in the scattered disk of the Kuiper Belt, they cluster together in some really weird way. They shouldn't be doing that. They shouldn't be doing that at all. And the guys from Caltech produce this very elegant picture showing how these objects beautifully cluster. And they modeled it and they said, look, there's only one way that we can see to explain this clustering, and that is that there's something massive out there that's shepherding these objects into this particular arrangement. And they started to look at what the probability of that is, and it was huge. The probability was huge, 99.999 whatever percent. And they said, literally, Planet Nine, as they called it, must exist, because otherwise, how can you explain this? There's no other way of explaining it. So then I started to think, well, okay, well, if that's the case, then how do you explain this whole thing with the infrared telescopes and the other surveys that have done that have effectively ruled out the possibility of Planet X, which kind of killed it a few years before that? And so suddenly I started to see papers popping up, which were like, well, it could work. It could work if you had this, maybe Wise missed that. And what I learned from that was that science can adjust very, very quickly when the facts change. So where something 5 years before was like, nope, Planet X, we can rule it out, doesn't exist, someone comes along and says, actually, this is telling us it really should exist. There's this kind of whole gradual adjustment. Well, yeah, maybe, I suppose it could if we tweak this, if we change that, if we take this into account. So, you could look at the science there and think, well, there's a subjective element to it. There's this kind of, well, they'll rule one thing out 1 minute and then they'll sort of say, well, maybe the next. So we're back, basically, the message is basically Planet X is back on the map and in a big way. And there's citizen science going on and all kinds to try and find this now.
Well, give me your percent on one if there's just one planet out there, extra planet, just one. What do you think the percent of that is?
Well, I can tell you what scientists think. I think people who are even quite neutral on this think it's about 80%.
That's huge. Now, what about the possibility of two planets?
Again, it depends on how far you go out. I mean, and it depends on how you define a planet. If you're talking about something sort of the size of the Earth or larger,
Right.
then, if you're talking about massive, big planets like gas giants and so on, then obviously the numbers get much smaller. If you're talking about something sort of Earth size or above, like a super Earth, if there's possibly two planets, then that might knock it down to, I don't know, 10% or something.
Okay, and then the third question is of these two that could be out there, what's the possibility of them being inhabited?
The bigger they get, the more likely it is that their internal heat and their ability to heat up moons provides a habitable environment. So
Even though they're way out there.
exactly, in fact, the more way out they are,
Are
the
they living in
more
darkness,
likely.
these inhabitants?
Right.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Okay,
Their eyeballs must be as big as baseballs.
so I've had to think a lot about this quite deeply to try and come up with these very, very good questions you've got, but it's the same questions that rack my mind. So let's say there's a planet quite considerably far out, and that it's a sub-brown dwarf, and we now know that Jupiter and Saturn have got auroras. They're quite active in so on in terms of their sort of radiation atmospheres and so on. Sitchin always said that Nibiru has some kind of radioactive material within it that kind of heats up the atmosphere and helps it. But I've always gone with this idea of there's a big object that's warming up these moons. So let's say it's quite far out and it's quite large. By becoming large, it becomes more easily detected because it's larger. So I start to think to myself, well, how is it that it's out there, but the indirect evidence points to its existence, but they haven't been able to find it. And in the last 3 years, you know, Brown and Battingen, they made predictions. They basically said, look, we should find this thing within a couple of years. And we're 3 years later now, and they still haven't found it. And I think, to be honest, they're getting a little despondent. So I'm starting to think, well, you know, and I sort of wrote about this before they even came out with their paper, you know, maybe there's something else going on out there. Maybe there's something out going on in the outer solar system in terms of the physics of the thing that is clouding this object and making it difficult to see. Because, you know, if we can determine, it's like having a bear out in the woods, out in the snow. We've seen the footprints, but we can't see the bear. And you can't, after a while, you start to think, well, maybe there isn't a bear because we can't find it. But right. The footprints are right. Telling you that it's there.
You know there's proof there.
Yeah.
The evidence
so, is... You know, so it's frustrating because they haven't been able to find this thing. It's really frustrating. And other scientists would say, well, that's because the footprints are explained by something else. Boom, 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 boom. Never mind. That's another story. So I start to think, well, there must be some kind of mechanism. Now, here's the thing. Out there, beyond a certain point in the solar system, these planets are in interstellar space. Our notion of the solar system goes so far, but we go up to a particular boundary called the heliopause, and beyond that boundary is interstellar space. And the Voyager spacecraft that got sent out in the 70s, it went past a load of planets and then kind of carried on out, they're actually kind of going through that barrier now, and they're actually plunging into interstellar space. So Planet X, kind of by definition, exists in interstellar space. So I started to think, well, maybe there's something else in interstellar space that means it's hidden from us in some way. Maybe it's wrapped up by something that's making it difficult for us to see. So I started to look at this, and I realized, and I don't really understand why other people haven't picked this up before, but I sort of realized that the conditions out there are different because of the way that dust moves around. And in our solar system, the sun does a great job of clearing out the dust and making it all very clear. But out beyond a certain area, it works in different ways. So I started contemplating the idea that this thing is in somehow wrapped up in some kind of, I don't know, like a nebula, and that the nebula would make it difficult to see. So you could have a warm object inside this nebula, which is effectively something, it's like putting you're cooking in the fridge. You put something hot in the fridge, but you can't see it because it's surrounded by something cold, or a person who's walking through a cold, foggy night. So like if you were using an infrared camera, it would be much more difficult to see them in the fog because they're in the middle of cold fog and it kind of obscures their heat signature. So this is the kind of thing I've been thinking about and trying to piece together with various scientific sort of studies that have been done or research that's been done. And I think there's some traction to this. The other possibility why they haven't been able to find it is because it's in a place which makes it very, very difficult to see. So the guys from Caltech who have been trying to search for this, and their colleagues in other parts of the astrophysics community, have been hunting for it in the constellation of Orion, which is a fantastic constellation, beautiful place to spot. But it's relatively clear. Now, if they've kind of done their calculations incorrectly in a way, and it's at the opposite end, and there's good reason to think that might be the case, then that plonks it into the zone that is got the Milky Way galaxy behind it, which is in a sort of zone of Sagittarius and so on. Now, if you've got a planet that's in this really intense star field, like the Milky Way, then it is literally a needle in a haystack. It's going to be really, really difficult to find. So there are explanations as to why this has not been found. It's very, very frustrating, but it doesn't detract from the fundamental evidence which is pointing to its existence.
What's your gut tell you, Andy? If you had to just lay it all on the line, what do you think's out there?
Okay, so I think that there is a very substantial planet, possibly bigger than the Planet Nine object. I still think it's bigger. That is warming a habitable moon that's going around it, that's got life on it, and it's potentially intelligent life, and that Zechariah Sitchin's work is vindicated through that. That's my starting point, but I think it's still a possibility. It's quite a long way out. It's quite a long way out.
Could be 10,000 years out as
maybe,
a orbit.
I mean, just it could be even longer than that, but it's quite a long way out, and it's obscured within this envelope, this nebula, and this nebula creates this shape because it's pushed back by the interstellar winds and so on, and that creates this wing disk shape. And you know, Sitchin was quite into this wing disk thing. He equated it with Nibiru for various reasons.
Could it be closer to another star as opposed to our sun?
Not really. Okay. That would be very, very far. It would effectively be in another star's backyard. That would be tricky. But, I mean, it's a long way out. So I think you're looking for this object that's basically a nebula that's shaped like a winged disk with this great big sort of planet, warmish planet, but stuck inside this cold nebula, which makes it very difficult to see. And there is something else moving between the two objects. So this sort of concept of Nibiru, this concept of the fairy, there's something. It's either, and people don't like me talking about comets. I get comments about talking about comets. But there's either a very substantial comet or another minor planet that is kind of shuttling between those two systems, at least part way. So it's like Halley's Comet, only it goes much further out. And that is your fairy, the thing that comes into the inner solar system, that appears, that is, you know, brings the gods with it or whatever it might be. That would be, at the moment, the way I perceive this. It's quite complicated. So it doesn't fit Occam's razor.
Is it dangerous, Andy, the planet?
Is it dangerous? Well, potentially the fairy is. You know, potentially the thing that is incoming every so often, which is a minor body, potentially that is. But, you know, we have to look at our own extinction record, yeah? If our extinction record on our planet says, you know, we tend to have an extinction event every 30 million years, then, I mean, you know, how dangerous is that? You know, okay, extinction event sounds pretty scary, but it's every 30 million years. So, you know, we can relax a little bit, you know. The extinction event that's going on our planet in context now, in terms of, you know, us wiping out huge numbers of species on our planet, is far greater than anything any comet's done. So, you know, we have to see it in some kind of context. So yes, potentially, but I don't think it's here and now. I don't think it's something we need to be worried about now.
Well, and again, would they warn us if something was happening? If something incoming was coming? Do you think they'd warn us?
No, I don't.
Because of panic?
I think that there was a film some years ago, wasn't there? A movie that was about this very thing, about them preparing and not telling the people. And you know, I mean, I think
it was an asteroid movie. I think.
Yeah, asteroid movie. And you know, when you, I think that made some very salient points. I know it did it in the form of fiction and so on, but I think it made some salient points.
Once the people found out, they went nuts.
Yeah, they did. But, you know, although that there is the capacity for that kind of national security issue and that the way that they would deal with that, although there's a capacity for that and one has to be mindful of that, I personally don't think there's the evidence to suggest that something's coming now at us. But other people will disagree. There are obviously lots of people out there who think differently to me. It's just, from my point of view, that's just my opinion.
Andy's book is called Dark Stars, New Evidence, The Scope of Our Growing Solar System, Planet X, Invisible Planetoids, Gas Giants, Comets, Planet Nine, and More. That's the book. That's the name of it. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And when we come back, promised phone calls, we will take your calls. Those of you on hold, just hang right with us. We'll get to you in a moment when we come right back after the break here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Andy Lloyd with us, his book, Darker Stars. We'll get to your calls as well. Andy, you supplied us with some incredible graphics that we have up there at our coasttocoastam.com website. Spectacular.
You know, I kind of dabble in a bit of art as well, George. I'm not an expert at, digital imagery, but I can play around with it a bit, and I've enjoyed producing some images. It's really, really important with this kind of thing to be able to see this stuff, to be able to appreciate it. And, you know, when we talk about the scales of the solar system, we talk about the planets and so on, it's sometimes a little bit hard to just have it in words. But I find communicating, and I do the same when I'm teaching, if I'm communicating visually as well as speaking, it helps people tremendously to be able to get to grips with some of these concepts.
All right, let's go to the phones. Bill, truck driving in the state of Washington. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, George and Andy. No, I don't think you should give up on Planet Nine. I mean, you know, the you were talking about the Oort cloud, the scattered disk object, and also the Kuiper belt. I mean, I don't see how, with the asteroid belt, the inner asteroid belt, not having enough mass to equal a planet, I don't see how all the scattered disk objects and Kuiper objects combined would be enough to perturb the orbit of the Jovian system. All right, and, you know, we're looking at a planetary nebula right now, NGC 7027, and, you know, they've discovered helium hydride in there. And all this basically is, you know, the mediocrity principle, I mean, in my mind. I mean, the universe tends to create life. I mean, it's, life isn't what is possible, it is what is probable, okay? And, yeah, there's something, more likely something massive out there. And you know, you discussed the orbital eccentricity of it. And this is, you know, and it does kind of confirm what we know in the geological record. But my main point is these religious texts, like the Mulapin and like the Mayan Quiche. I mean, you know, we can't even agree on the difference between a planetoid, a planetesimal, and a planet, all right? And we all speak, you know, English. We're trying to translate something from a very ancient document, and, you know, we could, there could be errors in translation, and I just, yeah, I just tend to believe, you know, I was just thinking about the Einstein interview, or the, when you were talking about Einstein last night,
yeah.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, we do live in a closed system. We live in a closed system, and if there is a massive object on a highly eccentric orbit, yeah, it would be, you know, the Earth is not separate, all right? We don't have a magic shield around us separating us from our neighbors. And yeah, probably would have cataclysmic effects as we define, you know, cataclysms.
Any thoughts on that, Andy?
Yeah, so the whole thing about the asteroid belt, of course, when Sitchin was talking about, writing about Nibiru, the concept was that there was this rogue planet that entered into the solar system and collided with sort of the Earth's precursor planet, which was a super Earth. And he didn't even know about super Earths at the time. So again, that's something that Sitchin kind of came up with, which way before his time. So it collided with this Tiamat, you know, from the Enumerelish, the Tiamat, the watery monster, and splattered the asteroid belt out. And so some of these, the debris that emerged from that collision splattered out into the asteroid belt. Some of it went out into the comets. As you rightly point out, the asteroid belt itself doesn't seem to have enough mass for it to be able to generate a planet in its own right. But as a debris field, it makes a whole bunch of sense. And then the Earth moves in. So the other thing that you alluded to, Bill, was like the movement of the gas giants. Now, the modern sort of physics understanding of how the solar system created is something called the Nice model, which involves the movement of these huge planets backwards and forwards around about the time that the gas in the protoplanetary disk sort of collapsed. And they were great gravitational movements, and these planets moved around. It's really complicated. The Nice model is just so complicated, and all these—it's like a huge game of billiards going on in the solar system. So actually, Sitchin's theory is a lot simpler, and it explains a lot of the anomalies within the solar system with respect to this rogue planet coming in and having this effect, and then shunting the Earth into the inner solar system. And I kind of alluded to this in my talk, but I didn't really get into it, and I apologize for this. But part of my interest is trying to find the clues on the Earth that determine whether the Earth started where we are now, or whether it started actually out beyond the snow line, beyond the asteroid belt a little bit, and actually started life there and got shunted in. Because if we could determine that, then we would be able to provide some substantial evidence. And one of the things that's really exciting with that is that the asteroids in the asteroid belt, the water that they've got and the water that's on Earth is very, very similar in an isotopic ratio, very, very similar, which sort of intimates that there is a relationship between our Earth and the asteroid belt, which, you know, needs thinking about.
All right, next up we go to first-time caller Ladia in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hi, Ladia.
Hi. Now, I have a question. I listened to your show for the last little bit, and you guys have been talking about a race that came down to genetically change us.
Right.
Do you think, have you ever seen Land of the Lost, the actual, like, the TV show? Do you think the producers of the show got the idea for the reptilian, for the space stacks from the people who've studied the reptilian race that came down and changed us?
Oh, there's no question that a lot of the Hollywood shows, in my opinion, have been spearheaded by actual events, investigative events, things that are going on, guests that we've had on this show, and that they've used that information to develop their own programs. What do you think, Andy?
The reptilian concept for me is a bit of a struggle because it gets tied in, you know, with my own stuff, I guess, and Sitchin's stuff with respect to the Anunnaki, because a lot of people who consider the Anunnaki and think about the Anunnaki tend to think of them in this reptilian format. Now, he used to write about them being, you know, more like us, you know, he's human. So if reptilian is a sort of a symbolic understanding in terms of, you know, the symbolism behind a snake and a serpent and so on, then I get that. But if it's actually literally sort of humanoid lizards walking around the place or shape-shifting lizards walking around the place, I start to have a little bit of an issue with that. But the underlying concept that in some way these powerful entities from our ancient past are still in some way being able to manage things. I don't rule it out, but I tend to keep that within the fiction. So when I write fictional stuff, I'll bring that into the fiction because, you know, evidence-based, I'm struggling a little bit with that. But it's an interesting idea.
Well, let's go to Alfonso in San Diego, California. Hi, Alfonso.
How you doing, George? I would like to ask Andy a question.
Sure.
There's two questions. The first question was, I was watching a movie called The Sixth Element, and that portrays that the evil entity coming into our solar system portraying Nibiru. That's one.
Mm-hmm.
It did say a time frame of 6,000 years. Now, the other question is, while watching the movie Moses, when he parted the water in the Black Sea or the Red Sea.
Red Sea, yeah.
He did mention and made a comment saying, let's go, we don't have enough time, it's coming. Did Moses knew something was coming up before the flood? And what caused the flood?
Let's talk about the flood for a moment here, Andy, because a lot of people believe that biblically speaking, it was caused by God trying to eradicate the bad elements on the planet. Others believe that this extra solar system planet caused it with its gravitational pull. What do you think?
So in Sitchin's book, he made that very point, George. You're absolutely right. And he was discussing a sort of a near side flyby past the Earth of Nibiru, which caused, his theory at the time, which caused the Antarctic ice sheet to shift, plunging it into the sea. And this would create a worldwide sort of tsunami that would then essentially be the biblical flood. So you would have seen, let's say this actually happened, you would have seen this red planet appearing in the sky. It may have had a halo around it. It might look like a comet. We don't know. It would have appeared in the sky as a portent. And then the catastrophism happened because something unstable upon the Earth shifted, whether it was a pole shift, whether it was whatever it was. Something shifted in the Earth to cause a catastrophe. Now, we know, my sort of take on this, and I write about this in Darker Stars, I devote a chapter to this, is that the Clovis comet event may be a very important part of this.
where there is a very serious consideration now as to whether the at the end of the last ice age was sort of interrupted or sort of brought about, or there was an event that meant that there was a massive melting of the northern ice sheet due to a comet impact. And of course, the actual evidence of the comet was largely lost because it got shattered into the ice sheet itself. So this Clovis comet then created an extinction event, or a fairly minor in the great scheme of things extinction event, but nonetheless an extinction event, and brought about the Earth changes. Now, I think that's probably quite reasonable. And that kind of event would have triggered a similar effect insofar as you would have had this tsunami, and the tsunami, you know, most we still do now, most settlements, we have them cities now, but most settlements are coastal. You know, we live near the coast. It's more temperate. It's easier life. You know, you've got the sea there, and you know, and so on. Abundance of life and food and so on. Now, coastal areas would be wiped out by those kind of changes because obviously a massive tsunami would just wipe out huge amounts of what was then the population, the Ice Age population. So I think there's something to that, and I think that the Göbekli Tepe settlement, which is up on the hills, I think Anatolia or Turkey. I think that's probably a post-apocalyptic refuge environment. And a lot of the monuments that they've built up there are trying to tell us, particularly Pillar 43, I think it is trying to tell us about the event and warn us of the event that took place. And I think that the timing of that seems to fit. So the other thing that you mentioned, Alfonso, was about the film that you saw. And I think it's Fifth Element.
Fifth Element. That's the one with Bruce Willis, right?
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. Alfonso, you're absolutely right. There is this incoming object that's kind of a burning sort of star-like object. And, you know, I took a video of this when I saw it because I saw it myself and I was like, oh, my God, I know exactly what that is. So, you know, they drew upon that. The makers of that film drew upon this particular sort of, whether you want to call it mythology or the catastrophic flavor of this incoming brown dwarf is part of that film. So it's quite an amazing thing to see, actually.
Okay, let's take a few more calls here. Jerry in Nashville, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hi, Jer. Go ahead.
Hey, Andy.
Hi.
George, how you doing?
Good. Thanks, Jerry.
I've been on a couple times. Listen, I've been trying to get on for a couple weeks. Now, for some strange reason, I was laying in bed trying to go to sleep, and then I just woke up, said, you got to call George.
Perfect.
Yeah, and I think I have some answers for you guys. I mean, I've been working on this since 1975 when I had my first UFO encounter, and then I had another one about 3 years ago. I wanted to ask you this question, George. Now, I see you on the show all the time, and Andy, I want you to chime in on this, but I've seen some similarities on that Ancient Aliens show that have not been connected in the show, and one of them is from Australia, and from our Native American Indians here in the United States. Now, they have almost the same drawings, and I'm going to get it probably mixed up, but one of them, one tribe calls it the Kachinas, and the other one calls it the Kachinos.
Kachinas. I think it's Kachinas.
Right, and the other one's Kachinas or Kachinos. It's just like one letter difference. Now, what is the similarity of that from two different cultures on the other side of the planet basically saying the same thing?
Well, you know what, Andy? When cultures from tremendous distances are saying the same thing, that tells me that whoever came down to this planet visited both of them.
Yes, I would agree with that. And one of the when you're looking at comparative religions and comparative mythologies, particularly going back a long way, the flood myth is one that's common to an awful lot of tribal groups or cultures throughout the planet, which in itself kind of begs the question, was there really some kind of event? And, you know, the people who study the Middle East, they tend to think when they're studying the sort of Bible and trying to work it out that it was some kind of maybe a localized event, the flood. But the comparative mythology sort of and the kind of symbolism that Jerry's talking about that you can see, you know, on pictographs and pictograms and so on, it does seem to suggest that actually something really did happen and people all over the world have tried to make sense of it. And, you know, if you lived through that kind of apocalyptic event, if you were one of the survivors, you would want to make absolutely sure that people knew about it in the future.
Absolutely. Andy, thank you for being on the program. You're invited back, my friend, anytime. Let's not let 10 years go by. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Alex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Bonnell, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.